IsraelSin.com.
Steve, I've come downtown today to King David Street, aptly named in the city of Jerusalem, right not far from the King David Hotel, across the street from the YMCA, to one of the gems of Jerusalem architecture, Hebrew Union College, or as it's known in Hebrew, Hebrew Union College, which houses, it's the home, the headquarters, the Israel headquarters of the World Union of Progressive Judaism, known in America as the Reform Synagogues. There's a school here for rabbinic students. There's a wonderful library. There are courtyards and classrooms, and it's just a delightful, delightful place. There's an auditorium. There's a wedding hall. So there are two different institutions in this large campus.
Right.
And the one that we're in is the Hebrew Union College. And the one next door is called Beit Shmuel, and that's
which
one
houses,
that's...
Which houses the Achsanya or hotel that was set up for visiting groups, etc., etc., and the offices of the World Union. And it also houses or is connected to the new Merkaz Shimshon, which is the big cultural center of the entire complex.
What I really wanted to make and to impress you with, Steve, is what a wonderful place this is. It's really right here in the heart of Jerusalem. The architecture is really delightful. It's got little hidden courtyards and fountains and gardens and a wonderful view of the walls of the old city.
Nelson Glick School of Biblical Archaeology.
Wonderful. Nelson Glick was an archaeologist who was here in the 40s and 50s, I think. Did some... And earlier, 30s, 40s, 50s, did some wonderful, wonderful work. Discovered, excavated, and taught about the earlier history of this land. And I'm sitting with a friend who's originally from Chicago and who's been here for a few years and found herself, I think, I don't know if she had previous intended to, working in the area of archaeology on a dig, on an archaeological excavation of a site in the northeast corner of the country called Tel Dan, the nature reserve, next to Kibbutz Dan, right at the foothill of the Golan Heights, although I understand it's on our side. So it was available for excavation even before 1967. How did you happen to get into archaeology, Gila? Was it a happening or was this an intent?
It was a happening. I was here studying Assyriology at Hebrew University, and I had to support myself and I had to get a job. And at the time I found a job, and I was the English language secretary of the Department of Business Administration, but I didn't really enjoy that. And so I was talking to people in my classes, and I was told that they were desperate for pottery drawers at the Israel Museum. Drawers. Draw pottery. And I said, pottery drawers? And I said, yes, it's a very, very needed profession and you can draw, so why don't you go over there and get yourself a job? So I said, okay. So I went over there. And two very lovely ladies, Margalit and Piri, were the two official pottery drawers at the Israel Museum. And they took me under their wing and taught me how to draw pottery according to all the conventions and everything. And I started doing that, and I got work, and I stopped being the English language secretary of the Department of Business Administration and just started to work in pottery drawing and object drawing and reading more. And to make a very, very long story short, I decided that I would think about archaeology as opposed to Assyriology, simply because I didn't want to be burning the candle at all ends. And Assyriology is a very, 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 very specialized field, and if you don't use it, you lose it. And I'm not an elbow pusher, and to wait for somebody to die to make my place is not really what I was looking forward to. And what finally decided me was when I switched from the Israel Museum to an excavation run by Shaul Weinberg, who was also head of the HUC here on a temporary basis. And he was digging at Tel Anafa, also in the north. And he took me there to draw pottery and to draw artifacts. But when they needed me, the architects asked me if I could join them in the field and help them out. And that clicked, and it was like I was born for it. And so I sort of fell into a hole and never got out.
And the hole you've been working on since I've known you is called Tel Dan. What is special about Tel Dan?
Tel Dan is physically a beautiful place. It has trees, it has water. It's a high tell in the middle of a valley, so you can see all around, and the only thing that's higher are the Golan Heights and the Hermon. And it is really beautiful. It's situated at the headwaters of the Jordan River, and it's on the crossroads from the coast to Damascus. It's on the crossroads from the Hula Valley, Hatzor, up into Lebanon. It has been settled since the Pottery Neolithic, in other words, the 5th millennium.
Which is 500 or 5,000 BC?
It's years old that we know of. That doesn't mean that there are places earlier than that within the site, but we've reached that only in one spot. That doesn't mean that it's the earliest. It's just as early as we've found. We found it on bedrock, but the bedrock goes up and goes down, and there may be places with earlier. And it goes through the Roman period and into the early Arab and into the Middle Ages. And the latest occupation of the site was a Muslim cemetery. And so it has a very, very long record of occupation. And it's also a very large site. It's 200 dunams, which is 20 hectares, 50 acres. It's very large. And the early bronze site was much, much larger. But what we see today when you arrive at the site are the remains of the ramparts of the Middle Bronze Age. And the Middle Bronze Age city was much, much smaller than the early bronze. The Bronze Age is a very long period, and it begins with the early Bronze Age in the 3rd millennium. And then you get the Middle Bronze Age, which runs 19th century into the 15th century. Then you have the Late Bronze Age, which runs into the 12th century. And then you have the beginning of the Iron Age, or the Israelite period, which is 12th century. We date the settlement of the tribe of Dan at Tel Dan to the 12th century.
1,200 years B.C.
B.C.E.,
thank you. We say the common era rather than before the individual. What was the settlement like in the when the tribe of Dan settled there? Do you see much? Is there much there of that period?
Unfortunately, the Danites were great pit diggers. They were possibly semi-nomadic. There was water around, and they could water their herds, and they could do agriculture and all of that. But there may have also been a semi-nomadic or semi-herding extra aspect to this, and there were tremendous amounts of grain. And they, without getting into the social fabric and how they were all developed and built their community, they dug huge pits and they dug small pits. And the huge pits seemed to run in lines, and they may have been public granaries or public storage areas, whereas some of the smaller pits would have been in individual courtyards, houses, insulae or blocks, whatever, of the settlement. But these pits are scattered everywhere where they settled and where they sat. And so they dug into the layers below, and the layers immediately below that were the Late Bronze. And so we do have remains of very large, very impressive Late Bronze Age structures, some of them apparently public structures, certainly not domestic, and houses, and some of the cultural artifacts and remains of how they lived. They had burials of children and infants below the floors of their houses, as was the custom in the Middle Bronze Age and in the Early Bronze Age, so that the children and the infants would stay with their families.
Did they have a very developed building, buildings at that period that you find?
There was very, very, very highly developed construction from the Early Bronze Age into the Late Bronze Age. But the Danites were these Israelites who came, not that they didn't know how to build, and they had many skills, but they came as a wandering people, even leaving the area of the camp of Dan around Gush Dan, and they made their way across the Jordan River, and then they went up the river, and then they crossed again, and they finally scouted out the land and ended up at what we now know as Dan. But these were not builders, or at least this first generation, these were not builders, they were agriculturalists, and they had these pits and huge pitoy and huge cooking pots. Theirs was a community-oriented society with families and individual homes, but they were more booths and tents and lean-tos than massive structures. And where we do have building that we can say, oh, this belongs to level six, it's usually small construction, small scale, that links to remains of larger earlier structures, and they moved within them and around them and set up their homes and their institutions in that way.
Are the earlier people the ones that we know of as called the Canaanites? Would that be correct?
I think that Canaan and Canaanites are the correct terms for the Bronze Age. Certainly in this part of the country, it's a term that is known from the Bible. It's a term that is used outside the Bible. It's a term that refers to peoples and areas that predated both the Israelites and the Philistines. And it's used by ancient peoples. There are those who say that in Eblah there are texts that talk about Canaan. There are people today who use, in the same sense, there's a very important book, Canaan, Israel, and Egypt, to differentiate and to show and to put Canaan in its proper place. And I think that it's the proper word.
One of the things that was very exciting when you were working there, and maybe you'll tell us about other things too, was something you found out in the parking lot that turned out to have significance. I think it was the parking lot you were telling us about when you were on your way walking to the car and there was a stone sticking out. No. You know what I'm talking about. So why don't you tell us the story without my getting it messed up?
Oh, it's one of those things that you sort of smile about, but you have to put it at the back of your head because you've let it come forward. You can't do anything else. So, you know, it was pretty amazing. As background, excavations more or less came to an end in around 1992. And then the Ministry of Tourism began a project at a number of archaeological sites to develop them for tourism, and Tel Dan was one of these sites. And at that time, we had exposed just to the east of the major lower Israelite gates to the city the beginnings of a very large stone piazza pavement. But we didn't know how far it went to the east, and we didn't know how far it went to the south. We knew that the city wall bounded it on the north and the city gate on the west. So one of the projects was to try to trace this to the south and to the east so that the Ministry of Tourism and the planners of this whole thing could see where the access would be into the site and into the nature reserve and where the parking lot would be, etc., etc. And so we started to work, and we just kept going to the east and going to the south and going to the east and going to the south, and we just kept going east and east and east, and we finally came across some walls, one on top of the other, as is so often the case, and started working and clearing and removing part in order to expose the rest, and photographing and planning and drawing everything as we went. And then it was the end of the season. The kind of work that I do almost never gets done completely during the actual digging season, because if we work until the very end, then there are certain things that are exposed in the last day or two of work, which cannot be properly cleaned in order to be properly photographed and properly drawn. And so there are always loose ends to tie up. And this was one of those occasions. Professor Buran came to me and said, "Day after tomorrow, I have to go up to Don to meet somebody. I have to be there at such and such an hour. I have tickets for a concert that evening with my wife. I have to be home by such and such a time. Do you want to come up and do some work?" I said, "Yes." We went up. He met whoever it was that he had to meet. And I was not working where this was found. I was working up on top near the upper Israelite gate, where we had extended the excavation there as well because of a very large pavement, and we wanted to see where it went. And we came across some rooms and very interesting things there. And I wanted to finish measuring and taking levels there. And then I hear Professor Buran, who had a very deep and a very booming voice. When he wanted to be heard, he could be heard. And I could hear him yell that he was finished, I should come down. So I waved to let him know that I had heard him, and I made as if I'm yelling back to him, but I didn't, because he wouldn't have heard me anyway. And I continued to work because I wanted to finish. And then I hear him again. I was drawing some more stones, and I had some help from one of the workers who worked for the nature reserve, and he would hold the lata so that I could take levels and put the levels on the stones so that I would know how high or how low they were. It's part of the planning process and the mapping process. And then I hear him again, and I had just finished, so I wave both hands and I give a yell, and I said to Aaron, who was working with me, "Give a yell too that I'm coming." I had a lot of and he helped me to pack up, and it was all downhill from there. And he asked me if I would need any help. I said no, and he wanted to get back to his work over there. So he helped me to pick up all this stuff and sort of aimed me down the hill. And I went down along this entire pavement and the entire royal processional way, all the way down through the gates and down to the piazza and across the piazza for another 15, 20 meters to this wall. And I just started letting down the stuff gently, and then bending over to, I had the measuring instrument on my shoulder on its tripod, and I just took it off my shoulder and bent over to lean it against this wall so that I could take it apart and get myself wrapped up and packed up and ready to go. And as I was putting it down and leaning it against the wall, my head automatically turned to the right because I'm right-handed, and I was leaning to the left, and I see this spitz of a stone sticking up, and it had these marks on it. So I looked away and continued with what I was doing, and then I looked back at it again, and I sort of wiped it with my hand, and they didn't go away, and it wasn't insect tracks, and it wasn't all kinds of other markings that you sometimes see on stone. So I said, "Nah," and I continue with what I'm doing, and then I look at it again, and I'm looking at it, and the lines, it was an inscription, and the lines were going up and down because it was on its side. So I turned my head a little bit more, and I said, "Oh, that's a kof." And then I said, "And that's a mem, and that's a lamed." So I stopped what I was doing, and Buran is pacing. He wants to go. It's getting late. And I stand up, and he looks at me, and I'm walking over toward him. And in my mind, I'm trying to say to myself, "Now, how do I say to this man, in good Hebrew, I'm going to make your day?" So I get over to him, and he looks at me very strange. I guess I had a very strange look on my face. And I walk up to him, and the only thing I can say is, "Bo, come.
Join me."
And he looks at me. I mean, I had never spoken to him that way. All I could say was, "Bo." And I turn around, and I start to walk. And I can hear that he's walking behind me. And I go over to where I was. And I couldn't say it. I just pointed with my finger. And he looks, and he doesn't see anything. And I walked behind him, and I literally took him by the shoulders and moved him to where I had been standing. And I said, "Tistakel." And he looks again, and he looks at me. And he looks back again, and he gets down on one knee and gets very close to it, and he looks at it. He looks up at me. Now, this is a man third generation Israeli. He was born here. He looks at this thing, and all he could say, and his Hebrew is wonderful, beautiful Hebrew. It was pride. He spoke a beautiful Hebrew, and he demanded that people around him use proper Hebrew. And all he could say was, "Oh my God,"
in English.
"Oh my God." And he also goes, and of course, nothing comes off. And he's going, he's not just picking up, he's beginning to read this thing. Well, he went back to his car, and he got the cameras, and he got all of his paraphernalia, which as a good Boy Scout, he always carried with him, including a blanket, thankfully. And we bring all this stuff back. He had a trowel, he had a little pick. And I started to draw where this thing was, and he started photographing it and taking levels. He held the latte for me. We get to the point where he says, "Okay, if you can see it, and even if I can see it," he says, "anybody can see it. We have to remove it. We cannot leave it." So we proceeded to excavate it, and we got it out, and he photographed it again. And we, you know, got the earth moved out from around it, and we propped it up so it wouldn't fall, and he photographed it again, and then we took it out, and he turned it around right side up, and photographed it some more, and then he gave it to me to sit down next to it and hold it so he could photograph it again. And then he had this blanket. We put it on the blanket between the two of us. We carried it to his car.
How big an object are we talking about?
We're talking about something that stands about yay high, about 40 centimeters high, and about 30 centimeters wide, but it's not one block. Rectangular, it's broken off, so it's not solid, but it's also got a lot of depth to it.
So how much do you think it weighed?
It probably weighed close to 50 pounds.
50?
Maybe more. I really don't know.
Right.
Don't know. He wasn't feeling any pain, and I wasn't feeling any pain. But it's good that we had the blanket to put it into, and we each picked up two corners of the blanket and carried it over to the car and got it up into the car. And then we went back and photographed some more and cleaned it up, and I drew what was around it and what was under it, and he held the latte again, and we took levels again, and we tidied up everything, and then we put some dirt back so that no one would see that we had taken something out. And we went to Jerusalem with a stop along the way to the man who was, his name don't remember right now, but he was the editor of Biron's first volume, 25 Years of Excavation, it's all done in Hebrew, and we stopped there at Kibbutz Ashdod Yaakov, and he was home, and we took it up to the second floor, put it on his living room floor, and the two of them sat down like two little boys in a sandbox. It's Chakla's wife, and I went off on the side, made coffee. They had a jolly good time. Biron looked at his watch, packed it up, down the stairs, back into the car. And then we went to Jerusalem, and we stopped at Yossi Neve's house. And we dropped it off at Yossi Neve's house, and Biron went home, and I went home. And that was the story of the day. And that was the Teldan inscription. The first of the three pieces that were found.
And what does it say?
Well, it talks about a king of Aram Damascus, written in Aramaic, and it does not mention his name specifically. That part is missing. But he is the king, and he went after in the footsteps of his father, and all this other kind of stuff that usually leads into these inscriptions, and mentions his father, but not by name, three different times, which is very important that he doesn't mention him by name. And he went forth and fought various kings and their chariots and their horsemen. And then he mentions the king of the house of David. And then the next line down is the king of Israel. But again, no names and no context. So you don't know where all these things are fitting in. And that was the first piece, and of course blew everyone's mind away, because it talked not only about the king of Israel, but it also mentions the house of David. And it is the first extra-biblical text dating to that period that's ever been found. And so that was very exciting.
What date do you ascribe to it, and how do you come to that conclusion?
It's dated to approximately the second quarter of the 9th century BCE, which would be someplace around 860 to 850, possibly a little bit later.
And what period do we date King David himself?
King David is 10th century, 11th, 10th century. You have David, you have the tribe of Dan, you have Jeroboam the First, you have
David, Solomon.
Solomon, yeah, and all of this, and then you have Jeroboam the First is actually with the divided monarchy. But you've got David, Solomon, and then you have the divided monarchy, and then you have the House of Omri in the north, and all the intrigues and everything else that goes on in Judah. But we're talking about the end of the House of Omri in the north. And we date it stratigraphically and archaeologically and also historically from what is known from biblical sources and extra-biblical sources. While David was never found outside the Bible before this, Ahab is attested in a number of places, Assyrian, and other kings are also noted by the Arameans and also by the Assyrians and by the Babylonians, and so this we have. And knowing who is talking about them and in what context, then we can put things into some kind of an order, even if you do not want to accept the Bible as 100% pure history. You can put things into context using other sources. And you also have the pottery, which is a huge corpus from Dan, and there's also a huge corpus from Chatzor and other northern sites, and comparisons with this material, with material of the same material, so you assume it's the same time period from across the Jordan or further north in Syria. And this is how you work things out. And then we have the stratigraphy on the site itself. If we know that this particular piece of stone was used as a building stone and was already smashed, we didn't find it standing in situ, we found it already smashed and reused as a building stone in a wall that is dated to the 9th century, anywhere from the third quarter of the 9th century up to the beginning of the 8th century, from the pottery that came with it and the pottery that's associated with it. And then you have a time frame. You have an historical time frame using outside sources. You have the local time frame of biblical, and you have the pottery, and you have the stratigraphy on the site itself of what came above what and what came below what.
There's one other object when we visited and you gave us the grand tour, one of the grand tours you gave us, was an altar that sat in the middle of a grove. And it doesn't necessarily mean that there were trees there 1,000 years ago, but at the point when we were there, it was very picturesque. And there's also a very picturesque entrance, which I understand has quite a bit of significance. The entrance to the city, to the old city there.
First, can we go back to the stela, the inscription? The stela being the stone. That was the first piece, and that was found in 1993. Then in 1994, two more pieces were found. One piece was noticed by Malka Hershkovitz, and the second piece I found. And it was, again, in use as a paving stone in the pavement in front, leading to the outer gate of the Israelite gate and against the city wall. Now this piece, even though it's the smallest, is the most significant because it has the only remains of actual names. It has the names of the king of the house of David and the king of Israel, whom the writer of this inscription claims to have killed in battle. And those two names are Yoram, the son of Ahab, and Ahaziah, who was the grandson of Jehoshaphat and the son of the Judean Joram. Joram was a king of Israel, and there was another Joram who was the king of Judah.
Where are these stones now, if somebody wanted to see them, even if they couldn't read them?
You were asking about the dating, okay? Now, in 2 Kings, Jehu is the one who supposedly kills these two kings as part of the Jehu reform against all the idolatry, etc., etc., that had been going on both in Israel under the house of Omri and also in Judah. And this is retribution to the house of Omri and the backsliders of Judah. According to 1 Kings, this was the prophecy of Eliyahu, Elijah, and 2 Kings, it was the prophecy of Elisha. And so we have, according to the Bible, Jehu does it. According to this inscription, and according to now the dates, because we know when these people reigned, and we know that the coup of Jehu was in 842 BCE, so it had to be before that. How far before that, we don't know, but it had to be just before that. But you have in this inscription that this king, who now, according to other outside sources, is probably Hazael, who was a usurper. And so this is one of the keys. We don't know who his father was, but we know that he was, from other historical sources, he was a usurper. Either he or one of his vassals who dealt with rebellious groups or fractious groups in this part of the Galil or the Golan put up this inscription. Now, the question is this at loggerheads, one outside source against the other, or is it, as Professor Buran pointed out, is it Hazael seeing Jehu as his agent in the ascendancy of Aram? Or, in the Bible, is Jehu given the credit, but Hazael is the agent? They're not necessarily contradicting each other. It's the viewpoint of who's looking at it and who wants to claim the credits or the rights.
It's very contemporary.
And it's also very, very, there's nothing new under the sun. Nothing new under the sun. But what's interesting is that, although at first glance, it's like one is contradicting the other. But when you think about it, not necessarily so. They are usually on public display put together because the pieces do fit together. They do not make the whole, but they do fit together. And they are generally on display at the Bronfman Biblical History Archaeology Department of the Israel Museum, but it's now undergoing reconstruction and repairs, etc., so the exhibit is closed. And here at the Skirbo Museum, on the grounds of this campus, we have a very fine replica of it, with all three pieces joined, and the transcription and the translation. And our museum, the Skirbo Museum, is open 3 days a week, Sunday, Tuesday, and Thursday from 10 till 4, open to the public, free.
Wonderful, Gila. That's a very exciting story, and it's a real story, something that really happened to you, that you found, that tells us about what happened here a long time ago. I appreciate your time, and I invite our listeners to let us know if they'd like to hear more about archaeology here in Israel. And those who come to Israel, we invite them to Jerusalem to the Hebrew Union College and the Skirbo Museum. And once again, Gila, thank you very much.